Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We have got a lot of state news that we're going to look at on the show today, but just a couple of quick headlines. By now, most people know that the Senate and the House have now approved the tax bill that they have been working on for weeks on end. It goes to the president this afternoon for signature, and we're expecting that sometime after the show is over with, sometime 3 o'clock or so, we're getting guidance from the White House that the president will have remarks about the bill. We're also beginning to hear comments from Speaker Ryan that the next step in all of this is not only to get the spending bill passed by the end of this week, but he's suggesting that when he comes back next year, the next big bite of the apple he wants is entitlement reform, which will only add to the controversy about this tax bill if they have to reduce Social Security and Medicare or Medicaid to make sure that they can pay for this bill. That's going to be a fascinating story to watch unfold. So that's happened today. Maybe we'll talk about it a little later in the show. But in the meantime, first of all, let me welcome Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the AJC. Wednesdays are your day. We're glad you're here.
I always look forward to Wednesdays.
We should get a photograph of Bluestein because you were at your daughter's...
Gym day.
Greg is here in a blue t-shirt and black gym shorts.
Dressed up. Dressed to impress.
Hey, it could have been swim day and he came in a Speedo or something. So it could be a lot worse.
Please take that picture out of my head. That's Tim Echols, a public service commissioner. And we're going to talk with him in a moment about a very big day that he has ahead of him tomorrow and a day that's going to have a big impact on all of us in the state of Georgia. We're also joined by our good friend Mary Margaret Oliver, a Democratic state representative from DeKalb County. We always love having you here, Mary Margaret. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
One of the things for me personally I always enjoy about you is you are a theater person. Good plays lately?
I went and saw Libby at Agnes' Express.
Oh,
no, that's always
Libby
wonderful.
Whittemore, one of the real great cabaret singers.
Great cabaret. It was a lovely evening.
Oh, good.
Hey, Lion King is coming to the Fox, and I'm taking my daughter to that. We're really looking forward
to it. Have you ever seen it before?
No, I've not seen it.
You are in for such an extraordinary thrill. As long as that show's been running, 20-plus years now, it is still every bit as exciting as it was when it first appeared. I can't wait to hear how they like it. Have you taken your kids?
No, but now I think I need to.
Yeah, apparently you do. All right, let's get down to serious business on the show today. Tim Echols, you do join us today, because tomorrow the PSC is going to make some significant decisions on what happens to the Plant Vogtle nuclear power facility out there near Augusta. There are two towers under construction currently, right?
Yeah, two units, we call them, or two reactors. Uh-huh.
Okay. And to set this up, let's first say that how long has this project been underway?
Well, I guess it was approved back in 2009, so they started moving dirt, the next year. So it's been going on for quite a while.
And initially, when they told their plans to all of us, but more importantly to the Public Service Commission, what did they say their completion date was going to be?
Well, they projected it to come online, last year. One unit last year and one unit this year. So they're definitely late getting here. Number of circumstances, to blame that on, but they are late.
Well, one of the big circumstances, and one that has really brought them to you again for your approval of their moving forward, is that the company that's building the reactors, Westinghouse, declared bankruptcy and really set everything on its head, yes?
Yeah, I think the great damage from the bankruptcy is it voided the contract, and it was in the contract where we had the protections, and so you had a fixed and firm, for folks that have ever built anything, a fixed and firm contract to set price. But when that contract went away, it's now kind of a time and materials contract with the ratepayers taking most of the risk.
Yeah, Greg, and that brings us to what the PSC is going to be looking at tomorrow. Georgia Power wants to continue building this facility, but they need the PSC to approve of passing the costs on to ratepayers, to customers who are already paying in advance for this facility. Mm-hmm.
We are billions behind, over budget. We are years behind schedule. Now, at the earliest it can be completed is late 2021. Mm-hmm. So years behind schedule. The future, as I think as you put it, the future of nuclear power in the U.S. could be at stake with tomorrow's vote.
Yeah, you're now talking. South Carolina was building reactors. They too experienced a bankruptcy in the structure, the corporate structure of the facility being built. They've decided to cancel their project. Vogtle becomes the only nuclear power construction project in the United States.
Yeah, it's really too much pressure on us. I didn't want our ratepayers to be the guinea pigs, you know, for this. And had I been in the negotiating room with Westinghouse on the bankruptcy and anything else, I would have negotiated some kind of royalty on any future reactors built to try to recover some of this money, over time through some kind of royalty that wasn't negotiated. So, the decision in front of us tomorrow is, do we give Georgia Power additional money, more cost and a longer schedule? And what do we get back in return for that? What kind of concessions are we going to get from them? And how is this thing going to go forward?
Mary Margaret, when Tim Echols says that they'll decide at the PSC tomorrow whether to give Georgia Power more money, what he is saying, he's not trying to mislead us, but what he is telling us is Georgia Power is going to ask the PSC to approve an increase in the amount of money that Georgia Power customers will pay on their monthly bills in advance of the completion of this project.
And as you know, the ratepayers have already been paying for this project pursuant to one of the most interesting successful Georgia Power lobbying efforts for Senate Bill 31 a number of years ago. We've already been paying for something that may not happen.
Senate Bill 31, asked to vote on whether, in fact, Georgia Power should have the power to bill us in advance for a facility that we knew wasn't going to be completed for any number of years down the road.
I voted no. Speaker David Ralston voted no. It was a fascinating exercise of power by the best lobbying team in Georgia. They never fail. They always get what they want, and they do it in a successful, professional way, and it's fascinating to watch. If you're a real nerd about politics, and I claim that role, this exercise of decision-making around Vogtle is fascinating. What the Public Service Commission does to manage this debacle of $6 billion being spent that the ratepayers have already spent billions on with no guarantee of recovery is a fascinating question. Are they really going to let Georgia Power continue to gain its power, earn its profit without any conditions based on the debacle of this failure to complete?
Tim, what are we, what are customers now paying toward completion of Vogtle and the current situation?
Yeah, so the amount that's been coming out on the bills is really just the interest. It's not the capital cost, but we did freeze that. We didn't say give it all back. We just froze it at the amount and says you can't take any more until these things are done. So that was taken care of.
Sure I understand. My power bill continues, though, to have a surcharge.
Yes,
but it goes to Georgia Power toward construction.
But let's say your surcharge is $8.35 a month. It will not go up anymore.
I see.
Until the project's finished.
You mean what's frozen is the amount of the surcharge, not that the payments are stopping.
And you're not getting, nobody's getting anything for free here. The money just will accumulate in another fund and will be compounded. I think the issue is if the plant break even is $9 billion, Georgia Power is asking us for 10.5. To make it simple, they're asking us for monies that will make the plant uneconomic. So the decision, I think, in front of me and the other commissioners is there justification, to go over the budget and give them an extra billion and a half and have this thing uneconomic? Could it be the 6,000 jobs out there, the 800 permanent jobs, our patriotic duty to keep the nuclear power nuclear energy going through plants? Is there some kind of way that we can justify it? And we'll see. I've got a motion that I'm going to present tomorrow, and we'll see if the commissioners agree with it.
I'd love to hear about that. My AJC colleague Jim Galloway has a column in today's paper outlining how you could maybe be the consensus builder in this group. What do you think your proposal might say?
Well, wait, before we do that, can I set the stage?
Yes.
So tomorrow, just to be clear for our listeners, George Power will come in front before you.
9 o'clock.
And ask, we need an additional charge on every Georgia Power bill.
No, that's not what they're asking.
They're not.
Mm-mm. They're asking us to certify a new cost that would be paid at a later date. But they're asking for the ability to charge ratepayers more in the future.
So it's not, are we talking about after completion?
After completion.
All right.
And without this, they could not continue construction on the project, right?
Okay.
That's correct.
So, okay. I'm glad you clarified that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So it's going to be money that's paid to them with increased rates. So rates would jump about 10%.
To guarantee their profit going forward.
In 2023, to give them back the capital that they spent, right, plus the interest that's allowed by law, which the commission sets, which is at 10.95%.
And right now, the average residential customer pays about $100 a year, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
For Vogel. And this could rise it to what?
Yeah, that cost is not going to go up.
That's going to be frozen.
That's going to be frozen. In fact, my motion, and I don't want to give too much of it away, but
You do.
But
this is Political Rewind.
My motion is actually going to refund some money on some bills
to customers,
to customers.
Consumers.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to have a refund mechanism in it, And I'm also asking for some additional solar power.
So Mary Margaret, what I just heard is interesting. Commissioner, has already said that he thinks George Power is going to present a cost to them that's above what they really need to build the plant, right?
No, above the break-even.
Above the break-even. No. Well, that's what I mean.
They need all the money. Okay. It just is above what it takes to break-even.
But what I'm hearing Tim Echols say, Mary Margaret, is that he's not comfortable that this motion will help assure that we're not contributing as customers to the full extent they might want us to, Georgia Power may want us to that money above the break-even point that Georgia Power does make as profit.
All these conversations are about Vogel moving forward. And that's really a basic question. Is it in our interest to continue to pay for Vogel into the future, given the uncertainties of where we are? It's a good and bad situation. We're the only plant left standing to make our way as guinea pigs. I think that's a very good analysis into whether or not this can be managed in any kind of business reasonable way. If it's successful, it increases our energy power surplus only by 3%, 4%? Is that right?
No, it takes it from 16% nuclear power to 21% nuclear power. So it looks like it's only doing 5%, but one Vogel reactor is the equivalent of about 10 million solar panels.
And compared to the fast-growing aspects of other energy growths, is this the best way to proceed? It's a very important question, and whether or not we make the right decision, given the reality that Georgia Power always gets what it wants, it gets a guaranteed profit, it gets guaranteed progress. I'm just curious, what are the conditions that are going to be placed upon them, if any?
Yeah, well, we've already heard some in terms of what you're going to propose, Tim.
Yeah, I think for me to be comfortable with it, and my motion has us clawing back some money. So if we're going to give them an extra billion and a half, I want to be able to claw back at least that much of their revenue requirement. And so this motion in Galloway in his article today mentioned my number, and my number is $1.7 billion. So it's not perfect, and it's not what all the interveners wanted, but I do feel like this compromise is probably the best I'm going to be able to get.
So, Greg, this is obviously a complicated issue. It's certainly hard for me to put my arms around all of it. But there are two things that I do understand fairly clearly. Number one is that we as customers of Georgia Power, all of us who are at some point, we're already paying $100 a year toward the completion of this plant. Once it's completed, if they get the vote tomorrow at the PSC, we will be then asked for another rate increase of 10%.
10% in 2023.
In our bills.
Either way, our rates are going up, even if it's not completed.
Well,
right?
And we want to get to that in a second. Yeah. In fact, let's get to that right now. Because here's why Tim Echols is quoted in the Jim Galloway piece today. I think you're the one who said it, is there really are no winners in this. Because even if the PSC doesn't approve the increase that Georgia Power wants and they have to shut it down, we're going to end up paying for the shutdown too.
Yeah, and we have already... We're already pot committed as customers too, because we've already spent a certain, how much has it been, $5 billion?
Yeah, we've got a sunk cost of about $5 billion in the project now.
$5 billion, and that's why when we had Speaker Ralston on the air here, was it just last week? He voted against that bill back in 2009, yep. Said he voted against it because he was worried that exactly what is happening now would happen. But he also said, we're so far down the road, it's hard to turn back.
It's a very important point to really understand the money here, which is dense. I'm always interested that I'm the most financially conservative person in the room. You are gambling to move forward with this project. It is a huge multi-billion dollar gamble. There is no history of success. There's no history of success. Is the more conservative stance to be to not move forward as South Carolina did?
There is history of success in the sense that the first two units that were there, that, by the way, went way over budget, that had tons of controversy. It's really deja vu all over again for us. But we've got that in our rearview mirror, and we see that, okay, those went over, and they're the cheapest energy we have right now. That wasn't so bad. And I think that's kind of how I'm thinking and some of the other commissioners are looking at it is, look, we survived that one. You know, I think we could survive this one.
Have we solved the nuclear waste issue?
No, we haven't solved that
so
problem
we
yet.
Haven't totally successfully resolved where we are with nuclear energy. I've been always supportive of nuclear energy, but there's a point where you have to make a very tough financial decision, and this is a scary one.
You know, Mary Margaret, during the 1991 General Assembly, were you in the Senate then in 91?
I was in 91.
Yeah, so if you remember, the first two Vogtle reactors went over, Georgia Power came with this plan in the legislature to change the whole way regulation worked. It was called the Integrated Resource Plan, and it passed. Boyd Pettit carried the legislation, a Democrat from Cartersville. Yeah, and that changed the compact, and it really lays the groundwork for where we're at today, and that is that legislation out of the General Assembly in 91 said that if the power company has the certified cost approved by the commission, then even if it's canceled, they get their sunk costs. That was vintage 1991 legislative work.
Wait, you lost me on this.
Yeah. Guaranteed profit is what
they
you're saying.
They get a guarantee even if the project goes down. This is what we're talking about when we say if you don't approve their increase and they shut down the project, we're still, as ratepayers, going to pay 6% on our bills to pay for the shutdown.
The $5 billion, they're going to be able to recover it. And that was what Georgia law said in 1991, and we still operate by that today. So it's not, Bill, that we can just willy-nilly sitting there at the commission bench go, well, I don't like you today, Georgia Power. I'm not going to give you this money. It has to be based on the law.
Mary Margaret, one of the quotes in Galloway's piece this morning, you read it, Tim Echols said, if we shut this thing down, consumers are never going to pay 6% more in their bills, and they're going to be paying for rusting rebar on that at that location. Is there something compelling about that to you?
I think it's a fair argument. To me, I'm not sure it's compelling to make the ultimate decision. The money at stake here is so huge, is so difficult to argue that this is the way we should spend our money for energy in 2017, 2018. We also, as you know, are facing such an uncertain future in our federal leadership on these issues. President Trump says we're going back to coal, which, of course, I don't think anybody believes that, but I do think there's an uncertainty in our national leadership that makes this decision more difficult. It's a difficult decision. To me, the conservative decision may be to take our loss and not invest more money.
And I think if we were making a decision today on whether to build Plant Vogtle from scratch, that it would lose 5-0 at the commission. I do not think commissioners would do it based on the economics. But look, we started it back in 2009. We've already spent $5 billion. How can we simply abandon that, put it into rates, and have nothing to show for it when we can look over into South Carolina at the Columbia State Capitol and see heads are rolling over there, PSC commissioners being burned in effigy, laws being promoted to change the commission. It is a difficult mess.
All right, we need to get a break in. This is a conversation we're going to continue for a bit, and then we're going to turn to another story in which Georgia Power features prominently, and that's what the heck happened at the Atlanta airport, and how did the leaders of this city respond to the crisis of the power outage there? We'll get to all that and more after this break.
I'm Robin Young. When news breaks hundreds of miles away, we turn to those who know the community best.
Vanessa Rancagno of member station KQED reports.
He is a reporter with member station WRTU in San Juan.
And as Houston Public Media's Gail DeLotta reports.
Let's talk about this with Casey Morrell, who's a producer with KNPR. He's in Las Vegas.
Wherever the news breaks in 2018, we'll be there. Be here for us by making a year-end gift.
Go to gpb.org and click donate. And thanks.
State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, Public Service Commissioner Tim Echols, certainly the most important man in this room at this point,
right,
given
question.
What the PSC
no
is going
question.
To do tomorrow, and AJC political reporter Greg Bluestein at the table. As complicated it is as this is, there are two ways in which citizens really feel what's going on here. One is in the rates that we're going to pay, but the second is jobs, Greg. There are, 6,000 mm-hmm. people employed out in the Augusta area mm-hmm. working on this project. That's a huge employer.
And the Augusta Chronicle ran a Sunday piece outlining a sort of bleak landscape if this project were to be abandoned. And this, by the way, also makes it really, this shows you the 2009 vote, the no's and yeses were both across party lines. This was not a party line vote. This was Democrats and Republicans banded together to support this, and a coalition of Democrats and Republicans opposed it, which also shows how difficult this is for even Democrats. You have Stacey Abrams, who went on the record over the last week saying that she supports some sort of way forward for this plant, because labor unions support Stacey Abrams for her gubernatorial candidacy, and labor unions are also very powerfully behind this project continuing, because it's 6,000 relatively high paying jobs in an area of the state that needs high paying jobs.
So since you brought it up, let's very quickly run down where the gubernatorial candidates stand. You just said Stacey Abrams, Democratic candidate, thinks that there should be some way forward. Casey Cagle, Republican, Lieutenant Governor, has a big role in all this. He supports moving forward. Stacey Evans says the General Assembly, she wasn't in the Assembly at that point, but she agrees with those of you who voted against the bill that gave Georgia Power the right to charge ahead of completion. And so she says that she says we're in a difficult situation. And I'm not sure, I think she's sympathetic with the problem. I'm not sure she's actually said she wants it shut down.
No.
I don't think she has. All right. Hunter Hill, a Republican candidate, he supports continuation. Brian Kemp supports continuation. Clay Tippins, who is a businessman, says that Georgia Power has a cozy relationship with everyone under the Gold Dome, Mary Margaret, as you've pointed out.
Wow.
Cozy
is not the word I would use.
Yeah, well, he's waiting for you all to answer, to push Georgia Power to answer some hard questions on all of this. And Michael Williams is the one guy, not surprisingly,
yeah, he
Craig,
took the most aggressive stance.
Who's like, shut this thing down.
He called it plant cronyism and said it was plant crony capitalism. So you've got two of the seven candidates for governor. Only one of those seven candidates actually could have casted a ballot. that in 2009 on this. That was Stacey Abrams, and her campaign says she was actually recovering from pneumonia. She was excused that day. So no one actually has a vote on this issue, but you heard five of them were pretty supportive of it continuing, and one in particular, Michael Williams, said it's time to, you know, cut bait.
You know, Stacey and the union support, I mean, we had union guys in hard hats come and testify at the hearing last week, and what they told us that I didn't know is that when you go out to the plant as an apprentice and you start working as an apprentice, you're at a certain pay level, and within 5 years, as you go up the ladder, by the end of 5 years, if you pass everything and do everything you're supposed to, you can be a journeyman and you can be making 40% more. So you think about just the duration of this plant and what an enormous project it is, and how it's not only providing jobs, but it is providing upward mobility for union members who are not having to, you know, to move to Connecticut to work on a boat or go to California. They're working right here in Georgia.
And all those union members could be switched to working on infrastructure projects across Georgia, which I hope the federal government is going to fund in the near future, because we're in dire shapes there. Burke County has benefited from Georgia Power being there. They're an enormously effective, smart, contributing citizen in Burke County. But the provision of jobs can be played out elsewhere in Georgia for more benefit to the taxpayers and more benefit to the ratepayers. And there's other projects with good jobs to fund.
You know, one of the things, Bill, that I've been criticized for is the thought that tomorrow I'm going to do something uneconomic, right? That I'm going to try to move us forward into uneconomic territory. And I'm reminding people, look, I voted to keep a coal plant open in 2011 in Putnam County at Lake Sinclair, that we needed to do $1 billion worth of environmental control zone, that the other commissioners disagreed with me. We shut it down. But it would have provided an enormous boost for that county, for Baldwin County. And it turns out, with Georgia Power leaving that county, it was one-third of the Board of Education budget for Putnam County, and it has really impacted the school system. And I don't think as people think about, you know, oh, cancel the plant, Georgia Power's, you know, a mean company, you know, they're doing this and that. I don't think people think about the full breadth of what happens when you have that much money injected into a region and how it helps it.
But Georgia Power isn't. Aren't there other partners? They're major partners in Vogtle. All the EMCs. It's not only a Georgia Power show.
That's right. It's all the utilities in the entire state, with exception of a few that have opted out. Cobb EMC opted out.
So, I guess two questions: is there a future for nuclear power in the United States? You said before, Tim, and everybody should weigh in on this. But I'll start with you, Tim. You said you hate being. There's a lot of pressure. Being the guy who's one of the members of the PSC is going to have to decide this, and essentially you are giving a vote for or against nuclear power as the energy source of the future.
Yeah, certainly if we cancel this plant tomorrow. What commissioner in any other state wants to sign up for what we've gone through? I mean, they're not going to want to have these overruns and all of this drama. It's just commissioners don't like that kind of stress, and I think we're done. I think China, they're building over 20 reactors. I think they take over, they start exporting their technology, and it is essentially something we cede to another country. And I mean, it's a patriotic argument I'm making, but I really don't think it's incumbent upon Georgia ratepayers to carry all of that for the whole United States. And with them stripping the production tax credits out of the tax bill, I mean, how could they do that?
That's another big point
here. That is baffling to me. A bill that no Democrats were going to vote for, and they strip out the nuclear production tax credits and leave the wind and solar in there.
The proposal was that in this case, Georgia Power would have had $800 million in federal tax credits, but it was incumbent upon finishing the project by a certain date in 2020. They're beyond that date, and Greg, the Congress, in its wisdom, decided not to extend the deadline. Therefore, at least for the time being, that $800 million is off the table for
Georgia
Power. That
is a huge hole for Georgia Power to fill. And there are, I mean, Senator Isaacson and the Georgia delegation is confident that next year they can attack it onto some other bill or
Johnny
figure
Isaacson
a way.
Was clear that they have a specific plan. But the loss of, potential loss of $800 million of tax credit made me ask myself, does Georgia Power really want to go forward? No certainty in the national leadership, a very uncomfortable, high-risk financial adventure. Do they really want this gamble themselves, particularly if they can't get the $800 million tax credit back?
What struck me was something Commissioner Eccles said earlier. Even if you guys, the panel tomorrow, does green light this, like which we think is probably likely, green light this going forward, what other commission, even if you green light it, after what you said earlier, saying if this was to come up today as a brand new plant, it would be a 5-0 vote against. So if you're another, even if you green light it tomorrow, if you're another PSC commissioner in another state, you're looking at this as a cautionary tale no matter what.
You know, natural gas is so cheap and so much cleaner than coal. Everyone wants to do that. The plant's so much easier to build. You know, it's just, I believe one day those lines are going to be constrained. I believe one day we'll be exporting so much that prices will go up. So I feel like I can justify, you know, an 80-year investment based on things that might happen at year 30 and year 40. And so that's kind of how I'm looking at it, very long term.
You said, and then we're going to change subject, but one final note on this, because I think we all at this table believe that you're going to approve this tomorrow with conditions. And I just want to very briefly.
I hope conditions.
Well, Tim has already talked about a couple. You said you're going to have a little bit of solar thrown into the mix here. That's why I asked you the question about whether nuclear is the future. You've already said natural gas would be your preference, but solar, wind power, all of these alternative energy sources certainly have potential for the state of Georgia. What are you going to suggest about solar tomorrow?
Well, I don't want to give it all away, but all right. Let's just say that if I have my way, that when you drive to the nuclear plant, that before you see the reactors, you're going to see solar panels.
All right. Let's turn to the other big story that we've been following this week. And Tim, actually, you play a role in this as well.
Greg, he's everywhere.
Yeah, he is everywhere. And you do because of Georgia Power. But Greg, you've done some just terrific reporting on the days following the crisis at Hartsfield when the lights went out. It is not an exaggeration to say this was a major crisis, is it?
It was. You had thousands of passengers stranded, tens of thousands of passengers stranded. You had flights all over the globe disrupted because, of course, this is the world's busiest airport. So it had ramifications, kind of ripple waves across the country and the world, and a huge hit to Atlanta's reputation. This is at a time where Amazon is looking to maybe place its second headquarters here, the very end of Mayor Reed's tenure as the mayor of Atlanta, in a time where, you know, it's every sort of reputational ding on Atlanta hurts even a little bit more as the city's trying to get Amazon. So this was a pretty much an international embarrassment.
So Mary Margaret, you could go down the list of people who have been taking hits because of this. And again, you would have to start, I assume, with Georgia Power.
It's a big black eye, and I saw President Bowers on television this week. It's a big black eye. Was it really just rats chewing through a wire? Is that what really happened?
That's among the rumors. We still don't have a cause yet, as far as I know, for the fire.
No, we don't.
And the fact that you don't have a backup for that.
Well, that's what I want to ask about. There was a redundancy that would have allowed this to have been a blip. But the question becomes, was it Georgia Power that chose the engineering which put that redundant system basically right next to the main source of energy being created there? Or was it done, did Georgia Power have the right to just say, they come in with blueprints and say, here's how we're going to do it. Here's the main power. Here's the redundant system. Oh, by the way, they're on top of one another.
You know, I think before we throw too many stones on this, we need only look to California and see how fast fires can get out of control. Mm-hmm. And we don't know for sure what happened down there. And we've got a data request into Georgia Power. We'll know they've got 30 days to respond, you know, for us to find out. You know, was it some imprudent action on their part, and what kind of financial you know, ramifications are going to be involved. But I think it's too early, you know, to really to take two of our best corporate, you know, entities, Delta and Georgia Power, and you know, and further damage their reputation.
I agree.
Think we just have to wait.
What mistakes? It reminds me a little bit of the bridge collapse and going first to blame the homeless guy and then blaming the DOT. That was a rush to, I mean, the circumstances of being able to look back on these crisis fires or crisis collapses is very, very complicated. What did happen? Why did this occur? We don't really know.
And I think we will soon. The FAA is investigating. The state is investigating. PSC is, as Commissioner Eccles just said, it was investigating. But real money damage happened, of course, too.
It was dangerous, too. It was very dangerous.
It was dangerous. I interviewed Mayor Reed the day after about the decision not to evacuate the airport. And he said the reason why we didn't evacuate the airport with it being totally evacuate the airport with the blacked out situation was we didn't want to spark a panic. I mean, fortunately, we had no severe injuries or no deaths of this. But you could have seen this going you know, a totally different way. But Delta is now saying that this cost them $25 to $50 million, and so we have one of those brand names you were just saying, talking about threatening potentially legal action to try to recoup some of those costs. So this is not going away.
I do think you're going to see all of that toned down. These are Delta and Georgia Power are two companies that understand public relations. They're both very good corporate citizens for Atlanta and Georgia, and they know that an ongoing fight between two of our best corporate citizens is not going to help us with anyone. So I think you're going to see it go quiet, and you're going to see these companies try to work things out.
Greg, your reporting included some observations from some of the critics about the way in which Mayor Reed did, in fact, communicate about this. He waited for quite a long time before he made a public statement. Give us a little background.
Yeah,
on that.
I mean, this was a tough situation because, as you mentioned, fires are never easy, and this was a fire in an underground electrical tunnel, essentially. The fire erupted around 12:45 p.m. on Sunday. It took firefighters about an hour and a half to 2 hours to put it out and then inspect the damage. Then it took even longer to clear the area of noxious fumes from electrical fire in a very cramped area. So they had to get fans there, blow the air out. Then it took Georgia Power inspectors more time, an hour or two more, to get down there, inspect the damage, see how they can get those redundant systems back up. At the same time, though, there was furious passengers upset that they hadn't heard any word from the airport about what was happening. Mayor Reed didn't have his first public statement about what was going on for about 6 hours after the fire started. So he came under a heap of criticism for a slower response. He said, "What would you guys have me do? Come and just say that there's a fire and nothing more. We don't know the cause. We don't know what happened." So his stance is he only wanted to come to the media when he knew exactly what it was and when they had a concrete determination of when the airport would open again. A lot of people in the airport would have said to us they just wanted to know some sort of information because there's so much chaos.
So, Mary Margaret, I understand that let's take to the extent we can the name Kasim Reed out of this. Let's not make this about Mayor Reed. Let me ask you a more general leadership question. What does a leader, it strikes me, and maybe I'm naive, that there were so many completely unforeseen circumstances here. That this is something that no one had ever prepared for. Now, in the future, we better be prepared for this sort of eventuality. But there were so many things that happened here. You couldn't get on a PA system and try to communicate with passengers who were stranded because there was no electricity to power those systems. Maybe there should be some sort of battery-operated system that does that. But my point is going to be, what do you see in general as the role of a leader in a situation like this?
We're in an era where transparency is a higher value than ever before. And I'm thinking about the unaccompanied minors in the airport, all of the staff that were responsible for ferrying these children and these disabled adults around in wheelchairs. There had to be a way to communicate. Everyone is safe. We have an electrical issue, and we are going to solve it, and we just can't know how long it's going to take. There had to be a way to communicate that. And even if I understand that leaders or Mayor Kasim Reed wanted more information before. But you have to tell people that we're safe and that this is being worked on and being resolved. Issues of transparency, issues of immediate information, I think were very important in any crisis, and this one particularly.
Tim, Greg mentioned the damage to Atlanta's reputation. I saw an article in the AJC this morning, which was a roundup of people who are in the image-making business, and many suggesting this is going to be easily forgiven. Yes, we did have snow jam that caused a lot of laughs in the northern half of the United States. Yes, we had the I-85 collapse, which was repaired remarkably quickly, to the credit of the state and the construction team that did that. And now we have this. Should people be now looking and saying, oh, my gosh, Amazon will never come here? In other words, what is the damage?
Yeah, I think that is the exposure we have. It's not that Greg and Mary Margaret and me and you aren't going to go to the Atlanta airport and we're going to drive to Birmingham to fly because we're concerned about a power outage. No, it's not going to impact us at all. But companies that are looking at Atlanta that somehow think, well, they're not as professional or they're not as prepared or they're not the big town I thought they were. They're a little small town. And I think that's the risk for us is how it impacts companies that are looking to move here. It's our corporate reputation that's at risk, in my opinion.
Let me just add this real quick, too. We're already seeing the beginnings, well, the middles of the Amazon effect as well, too. Between now and whenever Amazon decides on where to put its second headquarters, everything that happens to Atlanta, good or bad, gets a little heightened. It really does, though. People
it's
get
true.
Nervous, yeah. They get antsy, and it just adds another layer of stress. And we'll see that at the Capitol next year. All sorts, from religious liberty to even innocuous-sounding bills, they'll all be judged through a prism of whether or not this will influence Amazon's decision at all.
Mary Margaret, do you agree with Greg? I think he's right on the money on that.
I think there's a lot of discussion about Amazon and whether it was a homeless gentleman or misplaced wiring or whether or not it was rats in the underground of Atlanta airport. These are arguably unfair instances for Atlanta to be judged. We all have unfairness in our public relations challenges, and the discussion around Amazon is highlighting some of that. I think Atlanta Airport is an enormously positive asset for Amazon, for Mary Margaret Oliver, and for us. This mistake, if it was a mistake, caused a lot of money loss and damage, but nobody was hurt, and that's important.
I'm sorry to step on your last comment, but I got to get another break in. They're getting antsy in the control room, so let's get our second break of the show out of the way and come back and finish up with a couple of other subjects we want to address.
As you take time to give to the organizations that matter to you at this time of year, please remember that listener support powers everything you hear on GPB. Worldwide and statewide news, long-form interviews, and stories that connect us with each other. There's still time to make a tax-deductible year-end gift. Please take a moment now to go to gpb.org and click the donate button at the top of the page. From all of us at GPB, thank you for your support and happy holidays.
On the next Fresh Air, Chris Quest Rainey, whose story is told in the new documentary Quest. The film follows him and his wife for nearly a decade. Quest runs a hip-hop studio in their basement. A turning point is when their daughter gets shot in the eye. Join us.
Tune in for Fresh Air. It's this afternoon at 3 here on listener-supported GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We have Public Service Commissioner Tim Echols with us. Tim, I can only wish you well for tomorrow and appreciate your sticking with us throughout today's show. State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, DeKalb County, is here. And, of course, Greg Bluestein joins us. All right, I'm going to throw something out at you that you're not, I haven't even suggested we were going to talk about, but you can improvise.
Okay.
I was fascinated by the story I read. Well, you wrote it, so you know, I just saw it was your byline. The ACLU threatening a lawsuit against politicians who delete critical comments from their Facebook or Twitter feed.
Yeah.
What?
I love. So they sent letters to four government agencies. They sent it to Representative Congressman Drew Ferguson and two sheriff's offices and a police department, saying that as official organs, as official means of communication, that they should not be, quote unquote, censoring, their constituents or their residents' comments. And I'll say Drew Ferguson reversed course after he got that letter and said, whoops, we inadvertently blocked some of these people. We're going to restore their access. The several police departments did not immediately respond to requests for comment. But this could have ramifications for a host of other politicians
sure.
and public servants all across the state.
So Mary Margaret and Tim, you both are public officials who get Tim Echols has backed away. He used to be one of the most prolific tweeters in state government. I've noticed you have, but let me ask Mary Margaret first.
Well,
must get criticism on your Facebook page.
You think? As somebody who wants to ban assault weapons, I only hurled for 3,000 people who had not nice things
so
to say.
So when you see them, what do your people tell you about keeping those messages up?
Well, I'm really thinking about this as a lawyer. This is an open records issue. Is that what it is? I mean, the General Assembly isn't covered by open records. Yeah.
Well, it's a First Amendment. They're arguing it's a First Amendment issue that you shouldn't restrict the public's access to a public forum.
But once they access it, you shouldn't delete it because mm-hmm. then you've eliminated the public record that you intentionally created on a public entity. So I think it's very dangerous to delete criticisms. But I also will say, having been threatened in criminal ways based on my gun positions, and I don't talk about the specifics of that, I was pretty surprised at some of the things that Facebook would allow to be said on the Facebook.
That said, do you eliminate those messages?
I eliminated profanities.
Okay. The rest you leave up?
No, not all of them. I mean, profanities are eliminated. Personally, nastiness is eliminated. I don't know that I have a very bright line about that.
Okay.
Criticism stay. I get many, many polite, thoughtful, critical comments.
Yeah.
But if it's profane, if it's threatening, I'll delete it.
Sure. Tim, have you backed away from Twitter out of a concern about having a too public a face there? And
No. I mean, Twitter and Facebook are so different, right? I mean, only probably 11% of social media users have a Twitter account.
Okay, but
Facebook
you used to tweet like crazy. And I miss your tweets because you used to tweet about us all the time.
Well, that's because I was sitting there listening to your show and wanted to engage. The only reason I'm not tweeting your show is because I'm busy with Vocal.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But, they call them Facebook friends for a reason, right? So if you're my Facebook friend and you have that designation and I've clicked you in as one of my 5,000 friends and you come onto my page and say ugly things about me, then we're not going to be friends anymore. You can still say ugly things. I'm just going to let someone else be my friend the nature of a friend.
But Greg's article suggests that if ACLU gets any traction on this issue, you might not have the freedom to do that as an elected official.
Are they arguing it's a FOIA thing?
They make a distinction between a personal Facebook and an official Facebook.
Oh, okay.
Account,
right.
Where
okay.
Let's say Governor Deal's Twitter account where he makes news on the account, he sends out press releases. If Governor Deal was using that account to block people who he didn't like, who were saying things he didn't like, then that would be a potential actionable issue.
You know, the thing I love about social media is the fact that I can engage and interact with people that are different than me, that maybe have a different position, and I can, if they're saying ugly things about me, I take it to the direct message kind of mode, and then I try to talk them off the ledge. I engage with them privately, with a hope that in the end, maybe a day or two later, they come back on and say, you know, Tim Echols is a nice guy. He did listen to me. He did talk with me. So I do use it as a friend making machine, but I had to block a Republican colleague the other day who came on and was criticizing me about electric cars, saying that I needed to change parties and become a Democrat. And I basically direct message and said, look, you can't be my friend and come on and say that in public about me. I'm not going to allow that. So not only did I unfriend him, but I blocked him.
Ooh. And this is a prickly position, a question for a lot of politicians like you two guys. Mayor Reed is the most, probably the most famous blocker in all of Georgia politics, because he's probably, there's a running joke among in the political circles about how many people he's blocked.
It's a badge of honor.
It's a kind of a badge of honor.
By Kasim Reed.
I asked his office about that, and they say there's a distinction. This is his personal account. His official account, which is Mayor Kasim Reed, hasn't updated in 6 years, so he doesn't exactly use that one that much.
Is the ACLU argument that it's an official record that you can't change it?
It's that's an official record. It's public forum.
It's a partly a FOIA-related issue, open records issue in part, and a First Amendment issue.
And there is some case law. There was a federal judge in July in Virginia that ruled saying that a local lawmaker couldn't block one of her constituents. So there's some...
My attention in blocking is about profanity and threats. That's my attention.
Well, you know, it is not a social media page, but Greg, you know, our show, I spend a lot of time, more time looking at Political Insider blog nowadays, is because I'm always interested in the comments that readers make about what they've seen on or heard on our show. But I'm also interested in what they say in response to all the articles you and Tamar Hallerman and Galloway post. It's astonishing to me what your lawyers allow to appear on the website, because it can be brutally frank. It can be offensive in incredible ways. And
very
yet,
ugly. Very ugly.
Yes, but apparently the AJC, this is a matter of transparency.
Nobody
paying attention.
Yeah, I mean, if I wanted to sit there and moderate comments all day, I would have a very sad and long and lonely day. I personally don't really read them.
No, okay. I think it's not paying attention to the that allows people to say ugly things.
We have filters that block out racism and vulgarity.
Yeah, right. I don't see there. All right, we're out of time for today's show. Tim Echols, it's going to be fascinating to watch how you move forward, both you as an individual and some of the things you've said you're concerned about, and then your colleagues on the PSC. You start at 9 tomorrow morning. Is this going to go on for a long time?
Yeah, and we just started live streaming off of our website. So if folks go to just Google Public Service Commission of Georgia, and you can see the live stream starting at 9 a.m. We'll vote about 10:15. It'll be over and done with by 10:30.
All right. Thank you for being with us today. It was really a pleasure to have you here. Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, thank you. You're getting set. You got to get in really good shape for this upcoming session.
I'm ready.
Starts July 8th is a Monday. And Greg Bluestein, always great to have you here as well. We are back, tomorrow on Two-Way Street. We're going to do our annual Christmas show. I do a reading of Truman Capote's classic short story, A Christmas Memory. And then my wife, the playwright, Janice Schaefer, reads her own personal memoir of being a Jewish girl who wants a Christmas tree more than you can imagine. It's a story called Christmas Tree Envy. 2 o'clock tomorrow, Two-Way Street. And then Friday, we're back with another Political Rewind. Buddy Darden and Leo Smith will be here as we celebrate the last live show of 2017. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for listening. We'll see you down the road for Two-Way Street and Political Rewind.